So thank you everyone for coming to my talk, and also a very big thank you to the organizers for inviting us. So I met a few of members from the Perimeter Institute, and also met Ilya at one of these discussion sessions organized by DARPA. And that's where I kind of learned about causal inference, and I did go back and read papers from Rob Speckens, Ilya. I read some papers kind of broadly related to causal inference, and also papers from Rafael Chavez, and kind of made this little bit of a foray into this area, starting from that discussion. So when we started working in the area, one of the things that came about was related to the concept of entropic causal inference. And I know that at this really nice workshop that has been organized, the entire community, both from the quantum aspects and classical aspects, have come together to exchange ideas. I believe Murat Kuchaglu from Purdue ECE has given a talk, so I'll kind of quickly touch on that. And also one of my postdocs, who actually was jointly advised with my colleague, Professor Vanita Garwal. Ali has also given a talk, and all of us are kind of broadly trying to work on aspects of classical and quantum causal inference, but from an entropic point of view. So that's really the broad theme and context of the various talks in this workshop, and where this talks fit, where this talk fits in. So I want to acknowledge definitely my colleague, who Professor Vanita Garwal, who's also from Purdue, and he is going to give part of the talk with me. And he's also joining us. He's joining us actually from India. He's on sabbatical, so his time difference is kind of really extreme at this point. So thank you so much, Vanit, for joining for this talk. So I'll kind of, in the interest of time, and also because most of the audience members are really experts in this area, I won't belabor the point, kind of the importance of causal inference and the various ways we look at it. I wanted to mention that in the kind of simplest canonical case of just say two random variables, and you're trying to understand whether X is causing Y or Y is causing X, and is one of the kind of X causing a change in the distribution of Y, can we really understand this from a structural equation point of view and identify the causal direction? So there's been a lot of work on in this along this direction. Some of the early work is, say, previous to the entropic approach, is known as the additive noise models, where you have a structural equation of this form. And by understanding kind of the various complexity measures for this exogenous variable E in the X causing Y direction or Y causing X direction, by comparing them, you can actually try to understand which of these two equations are more probable for the observed data. So we had been looking at this about the time when actually, interestingly, Murat, who was interviewing at Purdue ECE, and I decided to go to his talk, and he actually spoke about this paper from his group. And I had a few discussions with him and tried to understand, you know, how does the entropic approach differ from the additive noise models? And I wanted to try to see if I could merge this. And that's when I kind of brought Vanit into the picture as well to start developing this. So this entropic approach right now is really at a nascent stage, but one of the things that we want to do is try to apply it to causal graphs in the near future, something like this, where we have different exogenous variables, and by understanding kind of their dependence and independencies, we should be able to really try to apply this a concept also to directed acyclic graphs. So in a nutshell, what is the entropic approach? Now, in cases where you may not be able to perform interventions, either for ethical reasons or maybe interventions are just not possible, in those cases, we need to have an approach which, say, uses observational data coupled with some minimal basic assumptions that you make on the structural equations or the causal models. And from there, it tries to identify the highly likely or a ranked list of, say, the causal directions, or at least rank which direction is more probable. So in that case, what the entropic approach does, it actually makes an assumption very crucial assumption that the entropy of the exogenous variable E is small in the causal direction versus the non-causal direction. So once you kind of have this working assumption in place, you can go and try to compute bounds on the entropy of this exogenous variable using the observed data and the marginal distributions. So once you have this, this is a workflow. I'm just trying to summarize the key idea. You can, from the observed data, evaluate the entropy of the exogenous variable in, say, the forward direction and the backward direction, in this case, say, X causing Y and Y causing X. And you can compare these two cases and make a prediction on what is the causal direction. So one way to understand this, I want to now try to provide a slightly different observational point of view to this argument and say this algorithm. And that is by say, let's look at say classical cause effect repositories. There have been many different approaches that have been applied, including additive noise models, entropic noise models. And the way this would look is something like what you see on the screen on the right-hand side, right? So there's some variable X. In this case, we just got it from this cause-effect repository. It's some, say, pixel value. And the Y is a variable is a screen brightness. Now, this is what your, say, joint probability distribution looks like. And you would like to ascertain from just this knowledge without any kind of underlying additional interventions or underlying theory models, whether X is can be considered to be a cause of Y or Y can be considered to be a cause of X. Now, I should mention that there are actually multiple layers of assumptions built in when we apply the entropic approach. That's not very obvious from just the data itself. Well, the first one is we have a model assuming that the entropy is less in the causal direction. But the other aspect, which is actually very important, is that this observed data is coming from a sensor or an experimental observation, which has unbiased estimators. This assumption is not present in the theory, but once we analyze it in more detail, if your experimental apparatus starts adding a lot of noise of its own, which is biased for variable X versus variable Y, many of the techniques, such as the entropic ones, would actually not be able to ascertain the causal direction. So we have that kind of assumption, which is necessary in even designing the interventions that are to be done on a data set. So from here, we actually try to understand this approach. We did apply it to, say, classical cause-effect repositories. And then the idea came about, can we start generalizing it just beyond this ideas where the nodes are just completely classical probability distributions and observed data? So to go beyond that, we have to try to look at defining structural equations which are slightly more involved than the classical one. So here, we don't make assumptions on the additive noise model. So this is E is your exogenous variable. But in the quantum case, there are many subtleties to actually get to a structural equation. So we decided to kind of put forth a model that kind of is consistent with actually non-local hidden variable theory. So in other words, you can think of this type of structural equation that we are defining as to be consistent with non-local hidden variable theory. And that actually makes it include ideas of kind of entangled systems and subsystems as well. So here, I have a tilde on here on kind of this sort of a observed data from a density matrix. And we call this kind of an instance conditional and observational density matrix. And we use that to actually define a structural equation, which generalizes the classical structural equation with an exogenous variable right here. And so in other words, even if you had a quantum kind of system, it is possible to make it kind of consistent with observations which have entanglement included as well, as long as you kind of work towards this non-local structural equations. So what we do here is, inspired from the classical algorithm, we try to look at the non-local structural equations and try to find the entropy of the exogenous variable, and again build on the assumption that it is actually lower in the causal direction versus the non-causal direction. So the problem then reduces that, given a data set, how can you estimate and bound the entropy of the exogenous variables in two directions and compare for the correct direction? So I'm going to request Vineet to talk to us a little bit about the assumptions going into the model, and kind of what we have done so far in terms of building the model and then applying this to also classical data sets, and trying to understand, you know, if we go about this generalization of this structural equations, taking into account some non-local correlations, can we start placing tighter bounds on even the classical data sets? So Vineet is going to talk to us a little bit about that. So Vineet, please unmute. Yeah, and go ahead.
Sure. All right. So I think, thanks, Zubin, for the great intro. So I'll be starting from further where Zubin stopped. So as mentioned, this is the density or the structural equations that we use for quantum causality. And the assumption we took from the classical, which is that the entropy of exogenous variable is lower in the causal direction. Okay, so so if we have to find which is the direction, x causing y or y causing x, we have to find the entropy of exogenous variable for both the forward and the backward direction, and then compare the two. Sorry. Okay. So first thing is, we have to find the entropy of the exogenous variable in each of the direction. So in order to do that, we define different rho ui's corresponding to the different values x can take. So corresponding to x equal to xi, we define the density matrix of the variable y, which is based on the function of xi and rho e. And we, for simplicity or abuse of notations, we also write it fxi rho e, meaning they are the same thing, actually. So having defined rho ui, we take the hint from classical. So in classical, the way we could write the entropy of the density matrix is, we could write this chain rule, which is the entropy of the joint rho e and joint random variable u1 to un, which we can call u. The entropy of rho e given rho u plus entropy of u, which is the joint entropy, minus the conditional difference. So this is how we were able to define the entropy of rho e in classical. This term, since we had to minimize it, this term was taken to be zero. This term similarly could be zero. So we had an inequality that it is greater than s of rho u1 to un. So in other words, the way in classical we found the rho e or the exogenous random variable was by finding the joint density matrix u, which reduces to ui when the observation is xi. So even though these inequalities do not necessarily hold in quantum, we use the same intuition to basically define rho e as the minimum entropy of u1 to un, the joint entropy, such that for this variable, joint variable u1 to un, it reduces to individual rho ui's in that projection. So more formally, we define rho ui based on rho of y given x equal to xi. And the exogenous variable is given as minimization over the joint density matrix, which minimizes the entropy of the joint density matrix such that the projection satisfies rho ui. So given we have the problem, the optimization problem to find the exogenous random variable in each direction, we propose a greedy algorithm to solve this optimization. And this greedy algorithm also takes a lot of intuitions from the classical approach, to solve the corresponding optimization problem. However, as you note, the difference is that all this formulation is in terms of density matrices and not in classical space. Okay. So this is an outline of the algorithm that we use. We go into the eigenspaces and then we use some of the intuitions from the classical approach of doing the joint entropy maximization algorithms. So having done this, we find the entropy of the exogenous variable, and then we determine whichever is the lowest, we determine that as the causal connection. So in order to show the approach works, we consider a simple example. We prepare X, Y in a superposition state, and then and they are perfectly entangled. If the first qubit is 0, second is 0, first is 1, second is 1. And then we pass the second qubit over a bit flip channel. So that's why in the second one with probability P, you have the bit flip on the second qubit. So we prepare a qubit in a joint entangled state and then pass the second qubit over a bit flip channel. And we are basically assuming that based on our matrices, we should have X as likely the cause and Y as likely the effect, even though these are not cause-effect examples, but intuitively, Y is a noisy version of X. And we basically say if something is a noisy version, that must be the effect based on our observation coming from the additive noise model that if we add a noise, then the noisy thing is an effect and the non-noisy thing is the cause. So in below, we basically mentioned that they satisfy the structural equations. If we take this value of rho xy, then we can compute the conditional density matrices. And this is showing essentially that the structural equations are satisfied for some rho e. This rho e may not be the optimal rho e, but at least there is a good rho e such that the conditions are satisfied. So as mentioned, we prepare a joint state and then transmit B over a noisy channel. And a Q here is, so in this case, So Q and P are the two forms of error probabilities. Q is 1 minus P in this case. And what we are saying is if there's an error probability over a bit flip channel, then if the error probability is 0.4, we still get A is the cause and B is the effect. For single bit flip channel as well as depolarizing channel, we get the same type of results that we can determine the correct causal direction. We also extended our formalism to a common confounder case. So in the common confounder case, we are basically asking whether there is a common confounder or whether there is a direction from A to B or B to A. So we applied our framework even on classical data sets, and we got better positive and negative examples, results compared to classical approaches. And the intuition is that we are doing a minimization between a trade-off, and the minimization approach searches over Hilbert space compared to random variable space. So we can actually get better accuracy over real data sets, even with common confounder evaluations. So to summarize, we defined the notion of quantum causality. We gave the approaches, extended the entropic approaches that were used for classical methods and extending them to quantum. And we also extended our framework to determine whether there is a common confounder or not, and applied those frameworks to different data sets, including Tubingian data set. Thank you. These are some of the papers that have resulted from our works in this direction.
Questions? I'm going to start with the question. It's a very basic one. Maybe I just missed some of the definition, but at one point you said that your assumption is that the noisier thing is the effect and the less noisy thing is the cause. I think I said that. But then when you were describing that formally, it sounded to me like you're saying find that the causal direction is the one wherein this the kind of noise variable for the effect has the smaller entropy. I would have expected you to say it's the one where it has the higher entropy, because then it means the effect is going to be very noisy. What am I missing? Is it?
Okay, so let me put it another way. So suppose you are sending something over a channel. In the forward direction, you have certain noise. Then in the reverse direction, intuitively, the noise is bigger. Right? So it is easier to encode than to go forward than to decode. So in essentially, the forward direction, the entropy of output given the input is lower. But once you are putting a decoder algorithm to denoise it, the denoising will have higher error. So that is the intuition, that when you are going in the forward direction of adding a noise, then you would have a lower entropy of output given the input compared to the other direction.
Okay. So I think I understand. Now let me tell you why my own intuition kind of pushes in the opposite direction. When I think thermodynamically, and I ask about the free energy cost, making the output have a small entropy is cooling. That's expensive. I have to spend energy to cool things down. So I would have said, hey, that if the example, you know, we were thinking about similar things. If I show you a picture of a glass of water that's frozen and a picture of a glass of water that's liquid, and I say, which is the early picture, which is the late picture? Well, on a hot summer day, it's very cheap to melt ice. That's the direction which I don't need to, you know, run a refrigerator or spend energy. So it's the more likely causal explanation. But it seems to me when you say that the more likely thing is the output given the input is low entropy, your intuition is opposite to that.
Right. So when you're sending things your intuition is also correct, but that is in a different system where reverting things is easier. But when you're sending things over a noisy channel, reversing is hard. Right. So if you have a bit flip, you cannot reverse the bit flip easily. Right. So when you have a noise going in the forward direction, reversing a noise is actually the harder part.
Okay. I think I'd have to think about that. Are there more questions?
Yeah. I have sort of a comment about this problem of orienting A to B. There are sort of two ways to think about that. Like, one way to think about it is like the way this talk and some others do, which is that in general, in certain situations, you can do things like look at the residual. Like you can regress it in either direction and look at the residual. You could use all of these. You could use entropy assumptions, right? And then there's like the Wingham algorithm. There's all of these algorithms on this, right? But another way to look at it is that. If you're thinking about DAGs abstractly as a Markov model, you have no business imposing edge orientation assumptions in there beyond the equivalence class. And I think, right, it depends. It depends how you frame the problem. And so, like, in fact, one of the sort of until recently open problems was if I have an arbitrary DAG, how do I write down the likelihood that agrees on the class? That was only known until recently from Gaussian historical paper, right? Because if you do it the naive way, which is you just parameterize Markov factors, then it's very easy to sneak in inadvertently some edge orientation stuff in there in the conditional distribution. So it's kind of depends how you want to think about it, right? If you want to think about a Markov model, the fact that you're parameterizing in the way that lets you orient the edges means you're not in the Markov model anymore. You're in the Markov model along with some additional crazy stuff that allows you to identify directions that you should, basically.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. Of course, means there are a lot of problems when you go bigger into DAGs. And that's why when you come up with this type of entropic architectures, you have to add a lot more assumptions, as was mentioned earlier in the talk too, that we are assuming confounders to be independent and bunch of other things. So yeah, means the problems are definitely harder. Depending on the approach, more different things would have different types of assumptions and different type of approaches. And we don't know which is the best. So that would be a subject of future investigation.
Okay. Thank you. Zubin, Vineet, let's thank them one more time. And
Thank you.
Thank you for having us once again.
Thanks.
I think it's Richard now, who's also virtual.
Okay, can you guys hear me and see my slides?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, great. I want to thank all organizers to putting together this wonderful program. So today I'm presenting about this, basically about these bounds for on the average treatment effect in terms of the instrument of variable models. As we know, there are stronger bounds known as the Borkhuis-Perl bounds and the weaker bounds known as the natural or Rabbitsky bounds. I'm just going to use this chance to clarify how this relates to the assumptions we make and also the latent variables. So I guess this talk is more or less motivated by the question, why statisticians, as I am a statistician, should care about this business of CHSH or Bell type inequalities. So the purpose is trying to present to you a concrete example where this is an issue that comes up for the study of partial identification, where you care about some causal quantity, but you can't get uniquely identify the quantity from the observed distribution, and you have to seek bounds. And I want to say that you probably do want to understand these inequalities in order to obtain the sharpest bounds. So once again, this is the instrument of variable model DAG, which I'm sure you have seen many times today. And I'm just focusing on the case where the instruments, the treatment, and the outcome Y, they are all binary. And I use this potential outcome notation Y of x, little z to denote the counterfactual potential outcome, how to impose and intervene the little x to x and the little z to z. And it's important that here I make no assumptions about the state space of this latent variable u that confounds the x and the y. And of course, as we know, this is the case where you can't uniquely identify the value of this average treatment. In fact, the average treatment, in fact, is defined as the mean, the difference between the mean of this counterfactual y of x, z, where you flip the value of x and without loss of generality, set the value of z at the baseline. You can't uniquely identify this from the observed distribution of x, y, and z. Instead, we want to somehow seek the sharpest possible bounds of this quantity. And we also have seen this today. So basically, this is phenomenal paper 97, Balkin and Perl. They obtained the sharp bounds, this quantity tau. So you don't have to look too closely at the expression, but just to remember, the lower bound is a maximum of 8 quantities, and the upper bound is a minimum over 8 quantities. And these quantities are linear or affine in the distribution of x, y, and z. So there are different ways you can establish the Borkhuis-Perl bounds, but I'm just going to focus on one way. They're usually established and proven to be sharp under the following two so-called cross-world assumptions. The two cross-world assumptions are this individual level exclusion and the joint exogeneity. So individual level exclusion says the random variable, the two potential outcomes where you keep the same value of x, but you flip the value of z, with the probability of one, they're equal. So that means for every individual, there is no effect from z whatsoever at all. So this basically would also justify, as more commonly written in the literature, that y of xz is only a function of x. And this assumption obviously is cross-world because you can't simultaneously observe these two values. The other assumption is this joint exogeneity that supposes that the z is independent jointly of these four counterfactuals, or if you assume the first one, the two counterfactuals. So this is called joint exogeneity because Z is independent of the random vector consisting of all the counterfactuals. And so basically these two assumptions which justify the Bokki-Pearl bounds, they are both cross-world. And this could be an issue when we pose those conditions. Because for the first one, the individual level exclusion, even if you are in a scenario where you can run a randomized experiment where you can randomize both Z and X, you have no way of consistently testing the first assumption. And for the second one, depending on who you talk to, it might seem a little bit implausible if you say this is an assumption made on observational studies. So the second assumption can, of course, hold by design if you can randomize Z, but in cases where Z is not randomized, then, you know, again, it would be a little bit dubious to justify in observational studies. So the natural question is then, can we replace these cross-world assumptions by their respective single-world assumptions and then derive the bounds on the average treatment path? So this is what I'm going to do. But before doing that, let me just add a little extra to the question just to better connect with the literature. So I'm going to assume there is a counterfactual of X indexed by the little z. And also I'm going to introduce there is a separate confounder U prime that is also latent, that is between Z and X, but it's important this confounder U prime is independent of the confounder U between X and Y. So these are little extras that just to better connect with the existing literature, and there is no essential role played by these two extras. So basically you can run the same argument I'm going to present without having these two extras. Okay, so now I'm going to replace the aforementioned two cross-world assumptions by their respective single-world assumptions. And an easy way to read off their counterparts is to look at this single-world intervention graph corresponding to this latent variable deck. So the first one is exactly encoded. The exclusion restriction is exactly encoded by this missing edge from Z to Y, as in the DAG, this missing edge from this split fixed node little z to this counterfactual Y of XZ. And you can read off from the SWIG, without this dashed edge, then this Y of XZ condition on U is independent of this fixed vertex little z. What that means is that conditioned on the latent variable U, the y of x zero has the same distribution as the y of x one. So where you flip the value of zero to one, that doesn't change this conditional distribution. So that is why this exclusion is called the latent variable stochastic exclusion. Stochastic means this is equal in distribution as opposed to the earlier condition where you require the two random variables to coincide. Because you're working with binary random variables, the equal in distribution can be replaced by the equal in conditional mean. So the second counterpart is the counterpart for exogeneity. Again, you can use the SWIG to read off that Z is independent of the latent U, and the Y of X, the condition on U is independent of both big Z and the counterfactual of X little Z. And I call the second condition the latent variable marginal exogeneity. So what is called marginal? So basically you can read off from these two statements that Z is marginally independent of this Y of little X little Z individual. So there are four marginal independences as opposed to the previous one, the Z has to be independent jointly of this random vector. Okay, so these are the two single world assumptions we're going to posit, and these assumptions are just can be read off from this week. Okay, now I'm going to use those assumptions, replace those assumptions, and to derive the bound of the ACE on the average treatment effect. I'm going to do this with linear program. So I'm going to create this linear program with two sets of programming variables. The first set of programming variable is this conditional probability table of all the counterfactuals conditioned on the two arms of Z. This is the first set. The second set is the two sets of conditional observed distributions of X, Y conditioned on Z. And of course, these are binary. And it's important for the way I'm doing the linear program here, because I don't want to say anything about the state space view. Here, I just basically does not relate U at all in the program. So U and U prime are not part of this program. And then I'm going to enforce the constraints. These conditional probability tables, they have to be simplex, so they have to be not negative, not 71. These are the constraints. And then these two sets of programming variables, they are related by this consistency condition, where you let the little x, little y, and the little z to run over the binary zero ones. And then I'm going to impose the previous two single world assumptions. But however, here, the single world assumptions makes reference to this latent variable u, which I don't wish them to enter my program. So somehow I have to eliminate this quantifier u. So elimination in this case is rather simple, just integrate out this u. And then you get the stochastic exclusion by integrating out u, and the marginal exogeneity, as I mentioned earlier, by integrating out u. And then these two assumptions remain single world, and they are just conditions where you can express using this conditional counterfactual probability table. And these are affine in the conditional probability table. And then because I want to get a bound on tau, and also add a tau, which is the affine function of the counterfactual probability table, as a programming variable, and this defines a degenerate convex polytope. And I use Frère masking or other algorithm to project onto the coordinates. So to get the convex polytope projected on the coordinates of the observed distribution and this quantity tau. Then here is what I get. I get actually not the previous bulky Poro bounds, but instead I get the so-called natural bounds or the Masky, the Robbins Masky bounds. So compared to the Vauquier-Poro bounds, this is a strictly looser bounds in the sense that the lower bound is maximum over the only four terms instead of the eight, and the same holds for the upper bound as well. So somehow we get a weaker bounds compared to the previous Vauquier-Poro bounds. So the talk is basically to investigate this question. So what is the cause of this gap between the two sets of the bounds? And is this gap due to the fact that we replace the cross-world counterfactual assumptions with the single world assumptions? So just to recall, I started this talk with the individual exclusion and joint exogeneity, and these are cross-world assumptions. And then I say I want to replace those assumptions by their single world counterparts, which are latent variable stochastic exclusion and latent variable marginal exclusion, exogeneity. And these assumptions, by integrating out u, the latent u, that gives the single world stochastic exclusion and the single world marginal exogeneity. So the leftmost two assumptions, these two, they are cross world, and while the four on the right, they are single world. So it's perfectly reasonable to guess the previous gap is due to the gap between the cross world and the single world. But I'm going to say that this is not the case actually. And it is the gap. The gap is exactly due to this translation. It's due to this quantifier elimination where it eliminated this latent U. So basically, the gap exactly stems from the fact that when we derive the stochastic exclusion from the latent variable stochastic exclusion and the marginal exogeneity from the latent variable marginal exogeneity by integrating out U, we have missed the CH-SH inequality implied just by the sheer existence of this latent variable U. So next, I show that this is exactly the case. We can basically close this gap by adding in the CHSE inequality. So again, this is the swig. And if I twist the limbs of the swig for a little bit, and then this just looks like the famous Bell's diagram. So it's not a surprise that there is going to be, once you assume that there is a latent U, there is going to be a CHSH inequality. So here I work in the case where I introduce this counterfactual X of Z, but the same argument would hold if you don't introduce of this X counterfactual at all. So the CHSH inequality is this bound of the correlations. And similarly, basically we can translate this inequality into our case. And this is the translation. This is the Bell CHSH inequality implying of this sweep. And if you look at this, this is a condition where we can impose on this counterfactual conditional probability table because this is condition is also affine in this object. So I'm going to close the gap now, try to close the gap by rerunning my linear program. So same as before, I code all these constraints, the simplex, the consistency, and the single word assumptions. Now I just add in my magic potion, in this case, the CHSH inequalities. And I do the same thing. And lo and behold, we just recover the Borki Perl bounds. So basically, let me summarize a bit. So basically, under this binary instrumental variable model, then under the latent variable stochastic exclusion and latent variable marginal exogeneity, which are conditions that you can read off from the population level swig for the latent variable DAC, the bulky Perl bounds hold and sharp for the average treatment depth. This is what we have shown. So I guess for the physicists in this audience, this may come as no surprise because you would say, of course, this is the case. But let me just try to reinterpret what this means if you're like me, a statistician or an econometrician. So just imagine for the moment, if you're a statistician and you work on the IV and all you want to conceptualize are those objects, the Z, X of Z, and a counterfactual Y of little Z, little X. So there is no latent variable U whatsoever that you want to conceptualize at this moment. Then also suppose all you want to posit are the single word assumptions. In this case, the stochastic exclusion and the marginal exogeneity. Both of those assumptions do not relate to a latent variable U. Then the question investigated in my talk is basically, what is this extra minimal condition that we need on these objects, on the Z, X and Z, and Y, X and Z, such that we can justify the Borki Perl bounds? And the answer is exactly this CHSH inequality, which of course would be implied if at the first place there is going to be a latent confounder U. So let me just summarize this little story. The conclusion is that the Borki Perl bounds does not really rely on the untestable cross-word assumptions, such as those such as the individual level exclusion and joint exogeneity. Instead, they can be perfectly justified just by the SWIG or FFR CISTG interpretation of the causal model plus the CHSH inequality. Of course, the CHSH essential inequality is automatically implied if there exists a latent variable G in the first place. And of course, one could argue then that you just said single word, but CHSH by itself is crossword. But I admit that is true, but this crossword is not a crossword assumption per se, is a consequence by the existence of latent variable U. And I also want to point out in the literature, actually, Phil David, in his earlier paper, he actually showed the Brocky-Pearl bounds and their tightness with the help of latent variable. But I guess David famously objects the use of counterfactuals. So somehow he didn't explicitly use counterfactuals in his derivation, but used something I would say very similar. So I want to say that for statisticians, the lesson here is that if we are really after the sharp bounds, then it's a good idea to understand the CHS or Bell inequalities, and also to read off the single world constraints from a graph that would contain both the observed and the counterfactual variables. And also linear programming can be a very useful tool, which has been, I think, very clear from today's talk. So a part of this material I presented can be found in my PhD thesis. And I also want to mention the way I did the linear programming in this case explicitly did not involve latent variable U. But I guess alternatively, you could include U in those linear variables by, with all its generality, assume a relatively large cardinality on such U. For example, I think 2^4, 16 would suffice in this case. So basically, if you want to include U directly in the linear program, you could use what Jin just talked about earlier. And then you don't have to add in the CHS inequality, then it just holds by itself because the latent variable U already exists in your linear program. So I guess that's all my talk. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Richard, that was great. But would you mind going back to your summary slide for a second? Because mm-hmm. there was something here that confused me, which is that you first said that CHSH is a cross-world fact. But then a few bullet points later, you said that Phil David derived the bounds. Okay, I guess that's not a contradiction, but he derived it without cross-world facts. So there's something I can confused about what is it that makes CHSH cross-world fact?
What makes CHSH a cross-world fact? So if you look at the CHSH inequality, that would involve random variables that live in two different worlds, right? So basically, the takeaway message is that you need something cross-world for the Brocky-Pearl bounds, for the stronger bounds. But the thing is to differentiate whether you are making those as assumptions and whether that is a fact that follows from the existence of latent variable. So I think we should make such a distinction.
I also have a very minor comment. Can you go back to where your squig is along with the observed data graph? So you were making population level exclusions at some point, right? So this is a question for Thomas and Jamie. So if you're going to make population level exclusions, is it correct to say that somehow the observed data graph has to have an edge from Z to Y, but when you split, you somehow that edge goes away or something like that? I think it has to do with one of the chapters of the SWIG paper where they reinterpret the SWIG's mean.
I never said there exists an edge from Z to Y. I just meant to say there is not such a dashed edge from Z to Y.
I thought that there were two different interpretations of SWIGs, one of which is individual level and one of which is population level, and you were talking about the population level one, right?
That's right. That's right.
But my point is that if you're going to make a population, if your SWIG on the slide has a population level interpretation, then certainly the edge from Z to Y in the SWIG should not be there under
right.
that
interpretation. Yeah. Yeah.
But mm-hmm. on the observed data diagram from which the SWIG came from, probably the edge should be there because you're not ruling out the existence of individual level effects, which is what those arrows mean.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. Okay.
Anyway, this is very minor. I just asked.
But not if it's a population level SWIG, right?
No.
That's not minor at all.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly the difference, which is that like you're allowing for.
Yeah. But I'm not asking about the SWIG, Robin. I'm asking about the observed data diagram.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Sorry, maybe I can ask a question that's kind of related to this. So there's a strong overlap between what you said, Richard, and what was in my tutorial on Monday, where I talked about the instrumental scenario where the instrument was three valued. And there we know that the Pearl inequalities for the compatibility constraints are necessary but not sufficient. And the Bonnet inequalities are giving you some extra constraints. And then I talked about a technique that's kind of like inflation, but allows you to intervene on some variables. So it's basically exactly the graph you've drawn here, this single world intervention graph.
Mm-hmm.
And I described how, like, if you only use the deseparation relations on that, you'll get the Pearl inequalities. And if you furthermore use Bell type constraints for that scenario, you'll get the Bonnet inequalities. And you know, Ellie was the one who explained this to me after seeing your, this is some of Ellie's work and it's very similar to what you're describing at the level of these bounds. So my question is, it seems to me like when we think about inflation and stuff that we have sort of two attitudes that you could take towards those inflated DAGs and those DAGs where you intervene. On the one hand, you could think about them as like twin networks where you're sort of describing counterfactual worlds that have some elements in common. On the other hand, you could just say, oh, that's just a different causal structure, but it has some symmetries among the parameters. And so my question is, when you talk about whether it's a single world or a cross world, like when in particular you said, you know, David derived this Balke-Pearl result, but without using counterfactuals, does it really just boil down to like whether you're thinking about this other graph as, you know, like a new causal possibility, or whether you're thinking of it as like a twin network?
The twin network versus what? Can you explain?
I'll try. I don't know, maybe
also gonna try.
Yeah, Ellie's gonna try.
One of the ways that we think about inflation is we say, if your distribution was generated by this causal process, and you really believe that there's a hidden variable model, then you say, look, there's going to be this thought experiment, which is if I recycle the same causal components, there should exist a distribution in some other experiment that I did not perform. And you can do this for the Bell scenario, where we have these sort of two outcomes, an outcome paralysis and outcome for Bob, settings paralysis and outcome. If you really believe that there's a hidden variable, U, which is what's relevant and X sort of depends on you functionally and similarly for Bob, then you could say, I believe that there exists some thought experiment where the value of the hidden variable, which is just some hidden number, doesn't just go to sort of two places, but at the same time, every event, it actually goes to four places. And so we get two outcomes for Alice-like experiments, except they can be doing different, querying different settings at the same time. And the same thing for Bob. And if you just posit the existence of such a distribution, that one could do such an experiment by virtue of the fact that we assume there's a Hindenburg model, then the existence of a distribution in this thought experiment, which has consistency conditions and relates certain marginals back to what you see, gives you the CHSH inequality. And that's a way of sort of saying, like, it's not about cross-world counterfactuals, it's about capturing consequences of a hidden variable model. But another way of doing that is to sort of say, like, oh, don't think about this as a thought experiment, about some experiment you could perform, recycling the same causal components. Imagine that you have like a twin network and you're actually now talking about different worlds which share something in common. And now it's exactly the same sort of pictorial thing and the same consistency conditions on the marginals. We're just interpreting it about counterfactuals and the existence of cross-world counterfactuals and the statement about cross-world counterfactuals. And I think what Rob is saying is maybe the answer to Ilya's question is, if you truly believe in a hidden variable model, consequences of there is a hidden variable model are the strongest possible statements that you would want to make, or at least very strong statements, about cross-world counterfactuals. Much stronger than population-level exclusion, much stronger than population-level exogeneity. The fact that there exists a hidden variable model means that you could draw a thought experiment where you could relate counterfactuals, but they wouldn't involve single-world counterfactuals. You could express the cross-world counterfactuals as margins of an experiment that you really could perform if there was a hidden variable model.
Okay, I think you're asking Richard. I think I disagree with you, but I will answer later because you're not asking me right now. You're asking Richard.
I'm sure I can. I'm not sure I can totally understand the question. But my impression of this is that I guess to get the bulky pearl balance, you have to imagine, you somehow use the fact that there is one world that those cross-world counterfactuals, they live in that one world. And it is that precisely the existence of this random variable that shows or manifests that there is one such world, I think. But I guess I'm coming from a different perspective where I want to separate the single world versus cross-world causal assumptions, or the causal model, assumptions on the causal model, and versus those implied by existence of such a single, such a world encompassing different counterfactuals. So I guess I'm coming from a different perspective, so I can't really answer a question. So I'll hand over to Ilya.
Well, yeah, I was typing up the answer, but I think I'll just say so. The way Ilya says it, it sounds like there is no room for stuff like heuristics at all, because heuristics assume hidden variables just fine, but they're just not willing to assume anything cross-world. That's just the thing about that model. So the way you would properly draw heuristic is a U that points to everything. It's just that you're lucky, and it's a special U with a special structure, such that anytime you construct a swig, and only a swig, a bunch of edges from this U disappear in a way that's helpful. But as soon as you start doing things like twin networks, where you start talking about cross-world variables at the same time in the same graph, suddenly that U messes everything up. And anytime you find yourself comparing a variable in one world and in another, you will find that U is a parent of them. So never will it allow anything like that, basically. So I think that's the way it gets cashed out in the heuristic.
So I think I would be okay with that. But this idea of, like, if you believe you have a causal model, then you could take these causal parameters and combine them in another way. So you could, like, in particular, broadcast U. But if you're in this, like, first thick model where there's really a U everywhere, and it's only when you look at one swig at a time that you see these independencies, then you would not recover the CHCH inequality, because you could and you wouldn't recover Bonnet inequality. These are not consequences of those causal models. They're only consequences of NPSC MIE, which is sort of captured by noting that in an NPSC MIE, the thought experiment that you could perform implies these kind of independencies on cross-world counterfactuals, which don't follow from first.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I was just making a narrow point, which is that I don't think it's necessary to equate hidden variable theories with cross-world stuff. I think that's the whole swig game, is you don't have to do that, basically. That's my take. But yeah, you're right. Of course, you're going to get stronger. That's the point of the talk, right? You get a nicer thing, nicer results, basically. If you assume.
Okay. Well, there doesn't seem to be any more questions, Richard. So we're going to adjourn for the day. So thanks very much for your talk.
Yeah, thank you. Enjoy the banquet.